Urbana.
This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
On Keeping the Faith this afternoon, we're talking via telephone with a pastor of an interracial church in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And we're talking with Reverend Wallace Bubar. Good to have you on the line.
Good to be here.
And I want to apologize for misspelling and mispronouncing your name in our promos. I'm sorry about that. But I
have heard it spelled and pronounced every possible way over the years, so I've long since stopped being offended by anything.
So it's B-U-B-A-R.
That's right.
Right. And how long have you been pastor of the Overbrook Church?
I have been pastor at Overbrook for just about 4 years now.
And where were you before coming to Overbrook?
Well, I was in your part of the country, actually. I was in the Midwest. I served a congregation in Iowa City, Iowa, for a little over 7 years. A college community there, right across the street from the University of Iowa.
7 years there. And what appealed to you about the Philadelphia situation, where it's interracial, it's multicultural? Why did you choose that kind of a church?
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting. I didn't have any particular connection in terms of family to Philadelphia. When we determined that it was time to start thinking about seeking a new call, we were pretty much open to going any place. And I was interested in serving in an urban context. I am a city kid at heart, grew up in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, and studied in Chicago and Atlanta. So I like being in a big city. That's exciting for me. But the particular situation of Overbrook Presbyterian Church really struck me from the very beginning when I first started learning about it. And part of that is its history, it's how it's evolved over the years into the multicultural congregation that it is today, and the fact that it's something that's really kind of happened organically. It wasn't something that they decided or took a vote on 50 years ago and said, now we're going to become a multicultural church. It really has just sort of evolved into that. And so that was something that interested me.
Let's talk a little bit about that history. How old of a church is it?
Overbrook is 123 years old. It's located in a historic part of Philadelphia called Overbrook Farms, and it is in the city of Philadelphia, but it's right across the street from Lower Merion, which is one of the older suburbs right outside of Philadelphia.
And Lower Merion is part of, is that actually on the main line of Philadelphia?
Yeah, we use that term, the main line. That refers to a string of suburbs and little towns that were along what used to be the old Pennsylvania Railroad, leaving Philadelphia, going out west, places like Marion and Wynwood and Bryn Mawr and Haverford, which was historically kind of the bastion of the old WASPy establishment in Philadelphia. That's where all the country clubs were and the cricket clubs and a Presbyterian church on every corner, it seemed.
And your congregation is Presbyterian, but you say in your website it's sort of purposefully ecumenical.
Well, yeah, I think most mainline Protestant congregations are finding, certainly that's been my experience, that the denominational label doesn't mean quite as much today as it used to. I mean, it used to be the case generations back that if you were born Methodist, you would marry a good Methodist woman and you would raise your children Methodist, and that's just kind of how it was. And now those distinctions are a lot more fluid than they once were. So, you know, the people that we attract, newcomers, come from a variety of backgrounds. We welcome two newcomers today. One was raised Roman Catholic, the other Congregationalist. So I find fewer and fewer people who were born and raised Presbyterian and have stayed that throughout their whole life.
What about you? Were you raised in a religious household, family?
I was. I grew up in Texas and was
so
actually
you, So you were Baptist, of course.
I was. Yeah, everybody in Texas is Baptist, yeah. I was raised in a Baptist church there. It was part of the Southern Baptist Convention, although it was one of the churches that was in the Southern Baptist Convention that never quite felt at home in that denomination once it started becoming more and more conservative and fundamentalist. So it was one of the more moderate or even liberal Baptist churches, kind of the Jimmy Carter brand of Baptist, if you will. But my mother was Baptist. My father was Presbyterian. And although we worshipped primarily in a Baptist church, I had a little bit of Presbyterian DNA in me, I guess.
Tell us about where you went from your family of origin.
Well, after graduating from high school, I chose to go to Baylor University in Texas. It's a Baptist school, and that's the place where good Baptist kids go in Texas when you graduate from high school. So I spent
well,
4 years.
Well, if you have certain academic credentials.
That's right. So I spent 4 years there studying religion and philosophy. Didn't intend when I went there to go into ministry at all. It was kind of the last thing I would have thought of. But here I am all these years later.
Where after Baylor?
I went to the University of Chicago and studied at the Divinity School there. At the time, I was really interested in teaching in an academic setting. So I went there to do a Master of Arts degree and with the plan of going on to do a PhD. But it was during that time that I was really wrestling with this sense of vocation. Where am I really called? Is it more to the academy or more to the church? And ultimately, the church won out in that tug of war.
Although you were at Iowa City, right across from the university, you said, the University of Iowa, and where you are at Overbrook in Philadelphia, you're surrounded by wonderful colleges.
Yeah, St. Joe's is right down the street, and of course Haverford and Bryn Mawr and Penn and Temple, and yeah, a whole slew of colleges. And I think certainly with Iowa City, that was the main attraction for me of going to a place like that. I really loved being in a college town and the diversity that goes with that and being at the intersection of faith and learning. And to me, that was just a very exciting place. And certainly Overbrook, although it's not a college community in quite the same way that it was in Iowa City, we have people from surrounding universities who call our church home, and that makes for a really exciting place to be.
Let's talk about the diversity. We mentioned in our promos of this program, we'd be talking about the fact that it's one of the very few interracial churches, interracial congregations, really in America. We, of course, go back to Martin Luther King's statement about the 11 o'clock Sunday hour being the most segregated hour of the week.
Right.
But your congregation is a great exception to that. Tell us about this natural progression that happened that ended up that way.
Well, it's interesting. We have scattered throughout the church a number of photographs over the years where they would take the entire congregation on some Sunday and get them all standing out front outside the church and take their picture. And so you can go back, you know, to the early 20th century and kind of trace the evolution of the church over time, just looking at the photographs of who's there in the pictures. And really what you see for the first, 80 or 90 years maybe of the church's history, it was a very homogenous congregation. It was all white up until the late 1960s. And not just white, but, you know, almost everybody at that time would have been from Scotch or English background. That was just, who Presbyterians were back in those days. And it was a pretty affluent congregation, folks who lived in the nice homes in Overbrook Farms and in Lower Merion. But that began to change in the 1960s. West Philadelphia, which had been predominantly a white neighborhood, started to see more ethnic diversity. And as that happened, the churches that were in that area, including Overbrook, were faced with a decision. How open are we going to be to these new families, new people who are moving into this neighborhood? A number of the churches that were in that area weren't comfortable with those kinds of changes and, in effect, closed their doors. And what wound up happening to those churches over time, they died out, and those churches aren't there anymore. And Overbrook was one of the few, really, that was just the opposite, that welcomed the newcomers who were arriving, and welcomed them into the church. And it was in 1968 or 69, I think, that the first person of color joined Overbrook. And since that time, it's just become more and more interracial, more and more diverse, more multicultural all the time.
What are some of the various racial, ethnic folks that are represented in the congregation? You mentioned African Americans.
Yeah, well, we have, you know, in terms of the demographic profile, we have about 60%, I would say, of our congregation is Anglo, about 30% African American, and then the rest, you know, comprises a whole smattering of other ethnic backgrounds. We have some Latino members. We have some Asian members, some from India. Actually, it's a very international congregation. We have about, I don't know, 10 or 12% of the congregation was born overseas, grew up speaking another language. I think 20 different nationalities represented in the congregation. So you kind of get the feeling like you're at the UN sometimes. It's not only interracial, but it's really multicultural, multilingual.
Demographics, of course, have been in the news a great deal the last couple of weeks, as we've seen as a result of the federal election, how demographics have affected that.
Yeah.
Your church seems to be fairly representative of the country as a whole.
I think so. You know, we use a lot of different metaphors for trying to express who we are and what we're about at Overbrook, but one, you know, slogan that I don't even know who came up with it. I think it was just somebody in the congregation sort of made the remark one time, but it kind of stuck, is that Overbrook is a church that looks like the world.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's true. It really is. I mean, just to give you some sense of that, I mentioned those older pictures that are hanging up of, you know, what the congregation looked like in the 30s and 40s and 50s. Our most recent confirmation class, I guess about 8 students, middle school students, two of them were African American. Two have parents who are from India. One Asian American. There were two students who were born in Germany and had just recently moved to America, so German was their mother tongue. And one Anglo American student in that group of 8. So really, just a very, very different picture from what the church looked like 40 or 50 or 60 years ago.
Let me reintroduce our guest today on Keeping the Faith. We're talking with Reverend Wallace Bubar, pastor of the Overbrook Church in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, located on the corner of Lancaster Avenue and Overbrook Avenue. No, City Avenue, excuse me.
Right.
In the Overbrook Farms area, historic area of Philadelphia. There are telephone numbers that you can use to join this conversation as you listen. Even if you're listening online, you may use a toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. That's 800-222-WILL, the call letters of the station. Listeners in the Champaign-Urbana listening area in the 217 area code may punch in 333-9455 for local lines. Your call will be answered by our engineer, Kyle Croa, and she'll put you in line to talk with our guest today, Wallace Bubar. Wallace, let's talk a little bit about some of the programs your church has for this diverse congregation, and tell us a little bit the size of the congregation. And we need to talk sometime about the fact that it's growing, which is unusual for progressive mainline congregations.
Well, that's true. To give you some sense of the size, we have about 375 members, I think. On a typical Sunday, we have about 180 maybe in worship. It really is, at least in our area, in our presbytery in Philadelphia, one of the few churches that's in a neighborhood like ours and theologically similar to ours that is growing. We just recently did some comparison with other congregations. Most churches that are like ours, kind of our peer churches in our denomination, have lost about 20% of their membership over the last 10 years, and that's pretty typical of, I think, most mainline Protestant churches and denominations, certainly. And during that same time, over the past 10 years, Overbrook has grown about 10%, not staggering growth by any means. It's steady growth, but it's headed in the right direction. And for whatever reason, people are seeking us out and are finding something that really connects with them.
So what are some of the programs that are available? And I should mention you have a wonderful website, which these days is often talked about as the real front door of congregations. It's the way people learn about you, but your website for Overbrook Church, let's give that URL so people could find
sure,
that if they're curious.
www.overbrookpresb.org.
P-R-E-S-B.
P-R-E-S-B.org.
.org. And tell us about some of the programs.
Sure. Well, like most churches, we have a full range of programs, you know, for children and for youth and for adults and music and all of that. But in the midst of the kinds of things that we offer, we do make it a point to try to offer things that are going to speak to a congregation like ours that consists of people from many different backgrounds. We do a lot of that in adult education, offering series that look at issues of faith and racial justice, for example. Even, you know, when we do Bible study, we look for ways to tie in something that might connect with our identity. So, for example, we recently did an Advent season Bible study looking at the stories of Advent through the lens of African-American spirituals. You know, Mary had a baby and go tell it on the mountain and that kind of thing. And what I find over and over in something like that is that just sort of using that lens helps you to see all kinds of things in a text, in a biblical text, that you might not have noticed otherwise. So I think, you know, we find those to be really enriching and make it a point of offering those kinds of things wherever we can.
Now, I notice you have a book club that's reading together Mary Carr's Lit, a memoir.
Right.
Quite a fascinating book that I happen to have enjoyed reading in the last year or two. How did you happen to pick that book?
Well, that particular club, I mean, I think that's a great example of what we're trying to do to foster dialogue within our congregation. It's a group that consists of people not only from our congregation, but from two other congregations in our area. One down the street, Bryn Mawr Presbyterian Church, which is a large, predominantly Anglo church, and another church that's in West Philadelphia, Winfield Presbyterian Church, which is a predominantly African-American congregation, and then Overbrook, which is an interracial, multiracial congregation. And so people from all three of those churches are coming together every month, mostly women, so they don't invite me, so I can't tell you what goes on in their meetings. But I know that they have rich discussion, and they rotate around meeting at each of the three churches, and I know that it has fostered relationships among those women who were participating that, you know, just wouldn't have happened elsewhere unless you sort of create a space where that can happen.
And you just yesterday and today had a fair trade gift market. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that's something we do every year, usually in November. We partner with organizations like 10,000 Villages and Equal Exchange that offer fair trade merchandise, gifts, and coffee, and all kinds of things, and fill up our fellowship hall with things from around the world. In case your listeners don't know, fair trade is a designation for items that are produced usually elsewhere around the world, but where the people that make them, the artisans and craftspeople and farmers that are growing the coffee, are paid a fair wage for their work. And so sometimes the things might be a little more expensive than they would be otherwise, but you know that by purchasing them, you're helping somebody to earn a real fair wage someplace. So we always do that, offer it to the community, and have a lot of folk who stopped by and did some of their Christmas shopping this weekend.
I want to talk some more about that in a minute, but we are about 20 minutes into our hour-long program where we're talking with Reverend Wallace Bubar from the Overbrook Church in Philadelphia, an interracial church, a multicultural church. But let me take just a short break and let listeners know what's coming up on Keeping the Faith here in the weeks ahead. Next week will be on November 25th, 2012. We'll be playing an archive program that's quite relevant. It was relevant back last June when we talked about it, and the issues are still very much before our nation. We're talking about the federal budget in this program. We're talking with the author, Ronald J. Sider. Ron Sider was the founder of Evangelical Christians for Social Action, and his most recent book is Fixing the Moral Deficit, A Balanced Way to Balance the Budget, the Federal Budget. It's a fascinating book. We had a wonderful conversation with Ron Sider last June when the book first came out. It's published by InterVarsity Press. It's a 2012 book. But, of course, the nation right now is discussing in Washington how to solve this great budget crunch that we're facing. And Ron Sider's suggestions on this are very thoughtful and, from a Christian perspective, quite interesting. So we're replaying that program. That's November 25th here on Keeping the Faith. So the Sunday after Thanksgiving, tune in for that archive program. Then December 2nd, Laura Frericks will be our guest. She's the director of the University of Illinois Research Park. Many universities around the country, really around the world, have founded research parks. And we'll be talking with Laura about sharing the value of sharing knowledge in these kind of enterprises. That's December 2nd. On December 9th, we're talking with two young adults who have been volunteers for their denomination, doing some very interesting projects. That's December 9. December 16, we're talking about an environmental issue with Professor Ty Newell from the University of Illinois, who recently crossed the country in a battery-driven car. So we'll talk about how successful that was. That's coming up December 16. Those are some of the programs ahead here on Keeping the Faith, which is heard, of course, on WILL 580 AM and simultaneously at 90.9 FM, HD3. And many people listen to podcasts later, but you can also hear this live via computer at will.illinois.edu/AM. Well, let's get back to our guest today, Wallace Bubar, and let me give the phone numbers if people would like to call and make a comment or ask a question, share an experience. If it's long distance, 800-222-9455. If it's Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455 in the 217 area code. Well, I want to talk a little bit more about your fair trade gift market. So why would a church have sell things? I mean, you know, there's that gospel story about Jesus driving money changers out of the temple.
And every now and then when we do this, I'll remind people in my announcements in worship, remember the money changers are standing right outside.
Yeah,
yeah, I mean, I think it's important for us to be mindful of where our money is going when we're buying something. And so fair trade, I mean, we make it a point around Overbrook to drink fair trade coffee at coffee hour. When we have on Palm Sunday our procession with the palms, we buy something called eco palms, and those come from a part of Latin America where it's a fair trade kind of arrangement. So we really make it a point to try to weave in that to anything that we're doing as a congregation. And so this just gives people an opportunity. They're going to be out buying some gifts anyway, and so this gives them a place to do that and an opportunity to know that their money is going to good use, I think, rather than just spending it at the mall or wherever else they know. And we actually lift up individual stories of people, coffee growers in Latin America or whatever, that are on the receiving end of this, so that people know it's a small thing for us to do, but it makes a big difference to other people around the world.
And what kind of a response do you get from your congregation in your neighborhood to this gift market where you sell these fair trade items?
Yeah, very enthusiastic. We've been doing it for a number of years. I don't know how many, probably longer than I've been there, probably 8 or 10 years maybe. And it's something that the community really enjoys. We have a farmer's market that takes place every Saturday outside the church in the parking lot. And so it's a way of kind of tying into that. We're one of the reasons why we host the farmer's market is because we want to support local agriculture and local farms, sustainable agriculture. And so this kind of gives us a way to do the same kind of thing indoors.
And you mentioned 10,000 villages in this university town where WILL is located, University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. We have a very wonderful store that's a 10,000 villages store that also handles fair trade items.
Yeah, it's a great place.
And as we talk about Overbrook Church, you also have some very traditional strengths. Your music program is certainly one of your strengths. I notice you have a sing-along coming up of Handel's Messiah that's in its 18th year.
Right. Our music program is one of the things that people see as one of the strengths of our congregation. And, I mean, if people hear that Overbrook is a multicultural church, an interracial church, and imagine that the music always reflects that or the worship always reflects that, I think that's an area where we probably have some room for growth. We have a wonderful music program with a wonderful director who's been there for almost 40 years. And I think over the course of his tenure, it was a very different church when he started 40 years ago. We've taken a lot of steps toward incorporating a diversity of musical styles and musical traditions. But for the most part, we're pretty solidly rooted in the traditional kind of classical European style of church music. So, yeah, a lot of Bach and a lot of Handel and a lot of Mendelssohn and that kind of thing. But interestingly, you know, I had a conversation with somebody not too long ago, one of our newer members who came from Togo, from West Africa. And I asked him, I said, well, what was it about Overbrook that connected with you? And he said, well, the music. I didn't expect to hear that answer from somebody from Togo. And so I said, well, tell me more about that. And he said, well, he had grown up in an Anglican church there. And so that was the music that he grew up listening to and singing in Africa. And so he found this to be something very similar to that. So it made me realize that I shouldn't necessarily have preconceived ideas about what somebody from another part of the world might connect with in terms of music.
I notice you're looking at your denomination's upcoming hymnal that will be coming out in 2013. I saw you had a hymn from the sampler that's been sent out for that. It's quite a diverse hymnal with music more representative of the wider world than some of the past hymnals have been. Do you have any sense of how people are responding to that possibility?
I think pretty enthusiastically. We're making it a point. A new hymnal is coming out next year, and that's something in most denominations it only happens every 20 or 25 years. So it's a big thing whenever a new hymnal comes out. And you're right that this hymnal will certainly go a lot further than previous hymnals had in incorporating music from other parts of the world, from other traditions. And so we've already obtained the sampler and are making it a point each month this year to learn one new hymn from another tradition besides our own. And generally that's been very well received. It's a congregation that is pretty open to new things being introduced. They don't want to have it all changed from one Sunday to the next, but when things are slipped in here or there, and when they're sort of made aware of why we're doing this and why it's important, people are very open and very receptive, I find.
This university has very recently had a visiting scholar on campus who lived in one of the living learning dorms and gave talks, informal talks, and answered questions for students while he was there for that week, James Lewin, and he wrote a book called Sundown Towns, where he examined across the United States towns which had either laws or very strictly enforced customs where people of color were not to be there after sundown. Strictly, were all white towns, only white people lived there. Blacks, Hispanics, Latinos could come in during the day to do various work, but they had to be gone by sundown. When he began the study, he expected to find most of those in the South. But what he discovered over the last 20 years of research is that, for example, in the state of Illinois, there were 600 such towns or suburbs.
Not what you would have expected.
No. Yeah, a huge surprise to him and to others. I don't know Philadelphia's history, so I don't know about those mainline suburbs, whether they had those kind of customs or even laws that sort of kept people of color out, but I suspect some of them might have. I don't know.
I don't know the answer to that, but I certainly know that our history as a nation, but even as a region, even as a state in Pennsylvania, is a good deal more complicated when it comes to race than we sometimes like to imagine. That was really made clear to us a couple of years ago. There was a new exhibit that opened up in Philadelphia, an old city right there along Independence Mall, right across from the Liberty Bell, called the President's House. And this was the house where George Washington and Martha Washington had lived for several years when he was president. Philadelphia was for a short time the capital of the nation before it moved to Washington. And so the Washingtons lived here in this home. And what was interesting about it was that they kept eight or nine African-American slaves in the house or adjacent to the house during the time that he was president and right there in the midst of Philadelphia. And so this was a chapter of America's history and of Philadelphia's history that it really hadn't dealt with in a long time. But as they were doing these archaeological excavations and uncovering the quarters where the slaves had lived and the rest of the house, and they were telling the stories of these nine slaves, and we know their names and we know a great deal about them, actually. And so as all of this was kind of coming up again, it forced us in Philadelphia to kind of grapple with our past and this legacy of racism and injustice that, is still very much with us. So I think we often like to tell a story of progress and, that's maybe how things were a long time ago, but we've come so far, and we like to congratulate ourselves on that. But I think the history is a good deal more complicated than we sometimes imagine.
I want to get back to that topic with our guest today, Wallace Bubar, but we do have our phone call, this time on line number one. Yes, you're on Keeping the Faith. Go right ahead. Line number one.
You were speaking about the sundown rules. That occurred here in Champaign-Urbana in the 60s yet, and graduate students who happened to be dark-colored because one reason or another, the people from India, East Africa, the Pacific Islands, Australia, were allowed to stay in basement rooms or in the top floors of things like College Hall. But a question that I would ask, and actually the type of, call it discrimination, is now determined mostly by money. But it continues a little worse than I think it was back in the 50s. The real question that I have is, we have grown to the point of not having caste laws like in India, where there is no longer a subcaste by legislation, even though it exists personally. Does the congregation run itself into something of a caste or economic or type of employment or amount of wealth brokerage among its members?
Yeah, that's a good question. where we are, I mean, we talk about ourselves as the church at the crossroads. You go a few blocks one direction into the suburbs, and you're in the midst of, you know, multi-million-dollar homes and public schools where, you know, they're the best public schools in the state, and every kid gets a laptop, and they're wonderful. You go just a couple of blocks the other direction into West Philadelphia, and it's a very, very, very different picture. You have tremendous poverty, tremendous need. You have crime. You have schools where, you know, they have terrible deficits, and they're shutting down the libraries and the sports programs because they don't have any money, and you've got 30 kids crammed into a classroom. And we're there, right there in the midst of it. And for the most part, the people who come to Overbrook, I would say, are mostly professional people, and that's true of, you know, whatever race, whatever ethnic background they are. So we're a fairly affluent congregation, but we do draw from a very wide range of socioeconomic status. So we have people who are CEOs of big companies, and we have people who are on food stamps, and they're sitting next to each other in the pews. And it's a pretty remarkable thing, actually, for a congregation. And sometimes I just look out at the congregation and wonder, how in the world did these people all come together? Because it's frankly inconceivable that some of them would have ever connected had it not been for a church like this.
Let me give the phone numbers again for other potential callers. In Champaign-Urbana, Illinois, 333-9455. If you're listening farther away, toll-free number, 800-222-9455. Wallace, when you were talking just now about the variety of the economic differences in your congregation, what's your meal program? I noticed it on your website. It's something called Heavenly Harvest?
Heavenly Harvest Meal. Yeah, that's a new program that we've undertaken just within the last couple of years. We got a grant to help get that started. And some of us, starting a couple of years ago, really started to feel the call to get more deeply involved in West Philadelphia. I mean, we're doing mission kinds of things all around the country and around the world with the fair trade market and that kind of thing. But we really wanted to be more deeply invested in our own community, in our own neighborhood. And so out of that kind of those early discussions, we entered into partnership with another congregation, Presbyterian Church, Calvin Presbyterian Church, which is a predominantly African-American congregation, just maybe a mile from our own. And we had already been working together with them on a number of other things. We do our Holy Week services together and a variety of other kinds of things. But we decided to start this new program together with Calvin, where we offer a healthy meal that is served every week on Thursday at lunchtime. And members of both churches are working together in the kitchen and serving it, and we wanted to be very intentional that this not be a homeless shelter kind of meal where people go through the line and get their tray and then sit down, but really more of a welcoming, inviting place where people are served at the tables and treated with dignity and respect, and we treat them as honored guests, and we sit down and eat with them and get to know them and get to hear their stories. And so it's really, as much as it is about feeding people and meeting those very physical needs, it's also about the relational aspect and trying to form community in a neighborhood where people have a lot of needs and a lot of challenges.
We're about 40 minutes into our Keeping the Faith program today, talking with the pastor of a interracial, multicultural church in Philadelphia, Reverend Wallace Bubar from Overbrook Presbyterian Church on the corner of City Avenue and Lancaster Avenue in Philadelphia. Let's take just a moment and hear about a program coming up here on WILL AM 580 tomorrow.
For Chicago, 12 days in 1919 may have set a record for calamities. A deadly airship crash, a little girl found murdered, a transit workers' strike, and widespread deadly race riots. These events are chronicled in City of Scoundrels, the 12 Days of Disaster that gave birth to modern Chicago. Gary Crist is the author. He's our guest on Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. Join me Monday morning at 10 on WILL AM 580.
And back on Keeping the Faith, let me just mention the program coming up here right after Christmas. That will be a particular interest, I think, as we see what happens with Israel and Gaza, the Palestinian Israeli difficulties happening now. On January 6th, we have scheduled a telephone interview with someone from Illinois who's now in the West Bank in Palestine, John Sutherland. He's a Lutheran pastor. And January 6th is the Orthodox Christmas Eve. And we will be talking with John Sutherland, we hope, from Bethlehem. Of course, many of you know Bethlehem is on the West Bank in Palestinian territory, and we're hoping to have a live telephone conversation with Pastor Sutherland on January 6th. While they're celebrating there, there are many Orthodox Christians in the Palestinian territories, as well as, of course, many Muslims and others, but in some Protestants and Catholics, but we hope to be able to do that if it's at all possible. So just to put down on your calendars as a hoped-for project, January 6th, to have that phone conversation with someone in Bethlehem. Well, getting back to Wallace Bubar and Overbrook Church, Wallace, I notice you put your sermons up on your website the day you preach them. Do you actually put them up before Sunday morning or right afterwards? Or
no, I usually put them up just afterwards.
Okay. So you want people to come to church, but if you can't, they can read your sermons
there.
They
can. I don't know if anybody does or not, but they're up there.
Well, I read one today. Our guest last week was a pastor of another interracial, multicultural church, Reggie Weaver from Chicago. He's an African-American in a church that is split probably 60-40 black-white. Uh-huh. How is it for you as a white pastor dealing with African-American folks who may come from a very different subculture?
Yeah, you know, it was something that I guess I was initially a little concerned about, just not knowing how I would be received. But I think, you know, I go into ministry with a sense of openness and knowing that I have a lot to learn from my parishioners, and I'm always eager to hear their stories. And I think when people see that you're really that you value them enough to want to hear stories of who they are and where they come from, then you can be their pastor. And that's across racial lines or any other kind of barrier. And I have learned so much from members of my congregation who are African American, and hearing some of their stories. I mean, I have people in my congregation who grew up in the South in the Jim Crow era and, you know, lived through all of that. And for them, this is still something that, you know, it's something they're very, very passionate about, understandably so. And it's really opened my eyes to be more aware and be more conscious of injustices and examples of racism that unfortunately are still very much with us. I really value the perspective, value the stories of my parishioners who come from backgrounds very different from my own.
We talked last week with Reverend Weaver about racism, of course, and how for white folks in this country, although we're now, I guess, a minority or almost to be a minority nationwide, there's still that privilege that is there whether you want it or not. There's still that power that's there in this culture because of our particular history. How do you train children in your congregation to be aware of that difficulty if they're Caucasian, and to be aware of that difficulty if they're not?
That is hard. We, I mean, it's the easy thing is to teach kids, oh, we're all God's children and we have to love each other and, sure. and you know, sing Kumbaya. And that's great and that's important. And we do that. But that's that doesn't get to the real heart of the kind of thing that you're talking about. Frankly, I don't know how good of a job we do at that, because you're right, there is still this intractable racism that, like it or not, you know, a person born into, you know, on one side of City Avenue in Philadelphia is going to have a very, very different kind of life from a person born on the other side of City Avenue. And it's very hard to for someone who is white and who has a whole lot of advantages and privileges that come because of that. It's hard to know what to do with that exactly. But I think in our church, what I see is people who are willing to come together and willing to be vulnerable, I think. You know, it's really coming together around the tables and being open and honest, talking honestly about race and racism. It's in those conversations where I think transformation can happen.
You mentioned people coming together around the table or tables. I also noticed something called a women's dining circles. What are those?
Women's Dining Circle was something that we started 2 or 3 years ago, part of our Mission and Outreach Committee. And the idea was to pull women together on a monthly basis, I guess, to have dinner, and but also to support a particular mission project. So we would have some representative from a mission organization that we were partnering with come and speak and make a presentation, and the women attending the dinner would contribute whatever they would pay for the cost of an ordinary dinner. And so we've raised, I think so far, $10,000, and then that money has been matched by our mission and outreach fund. So we've contributed, I think, $20,000 so far in the last couple of years to different projects. Our most recent one was an orphanage in South Africa. And so it's a great way to promote fellowship and a sense of community while also doing good in the process.
Now, you've mentioned a couple programs which are mainly for women, the book club and the dining circles. Many congregations these days are having trouble attracting males. Do you have any good examples, or are you having difficulties like most congregations?
You know, we did a sort of demographic survey analysis of our congregation just this past summer and learned that of active participants, I think about two-thirds maybe are women, and that's not uncommon. That's not atypical for Protestant churches. I don't know. We don't probably do a very good job of thinking about what kinds of things might appeal to men. We haven't offered particular programs geared toward them, so that's an area probably where we have some work to do.
You mentioned when you talked about deciding to leave Iowa City to go to this part of Philadelphia and be pastor of that church, you used the word we. You're married?
I am married, yes. Been married for almost 10 years and have two daughters.
How old are they?
They are 5 and almost 3.
So one was young when you made this move, and one has been bored since you went there.
That's right.
And how did your spouse feel about the change from Iowa City to Philadelphia?
Well, she loved Iowa City and loved the community there and her job. She's a high school English teacher, and so loved Iowa City, as did I, but she's really embraced Philadelphia. She's been pleased to find, she's from Germany originally. That's where she was born and raised, and there's a very large German community here in Philadelphia. So she's connected with them and gotten very involved in those kinds of things. So actually, she's helped to bring in and make our church even more multicultural by bringing in a large German contingent, or growing German contingent, I should say. So that's kind of our newest group that's become a part of what we're up to.
And has she chosen to focus on child care at this point, or is she doing some teaching?
She's doing some teaching. Actually, she's teaching at Temple University right now, part-time, teaching in their international English language program, so teaching international students from Asia, from the Middle East, who are just learning English for the first time, most of them.
And how have your girls found growing up in this congregation? Pastors' children often are singled out.
Well, they are, yeah, and they kind of think that they own the place because they run around and probably know all the little hiding places better than I do. And our daughters have gone to preschool at the church, and so they're there, or were there, Monday through Friday, and then again on Sunday, and are there just kind of all the time. So they think of it as their home. But they love it there. They feel warmly welcomed and taken care of there.
How multicultural is the preschool at your church?
Well, the preschool is probably not as multicultural as the congregation is. It tends to draw people, families from Lower Merion predominantly, although that's not only the case. I mean, there are families from West Philadelphia who come to the preschool, but it's a diverse crowd, and I think that's one of the things that both for the church and the preschool too, to some extent, it has been a real selling point, is that there are some families who are really looking for that. For some, it's we have a lot of interracial families. And they've kind of gravitated toward Overbrook as a place where they feel welcome and feel at home and where their children will feel welcome. And we have other families who are, you know, maybe Anglo families but living in the suburbs, but they want their children to be exposed to more diversity than they would find in their schools or in their neighborhoods. And so they come to Overbrook for that reason. So it's people coming for different reasons, but valuing the diversity and valuing our multicultural identity is really at the center of it.
We're talking on Keeping the Faith this afternoon with Reverend Wallace Bubar, B-U-B-A-R, who's pastor for the last 4 years of Overbrook Church in Philadelphia, a multicultural interracial church. If you'd like to ask a question, we're down to our last 5 or 6 minutes, but we can squeeze in another call or two. 333-9455 in the Champaign-Urbana listing area, the 217 area code. If it's long distance, 1-800-222-9455. If you've missed part of this program or would like to hear previous programs, I referred to the earlier one last week on this little mini-series on multicultural congregations. You can go to the WNL website. That's will.illinois.edu/keepingthefaith, and you can leave the G off of keeping, and you'll find all of our programs from past years, and you can listen at your convenience on your various devices, computers, and all kinds of things that can these days get online. Wallace, you mentioned the kind of worship services you have are say, it sounds like you're describing them as sort of a blended service, a more traditional with traditional music, but also with some surprises. What's your Taze service like on Wednesdays? And tell us what Taze is.
Sure. That's something we've just recently started in the last few months, actually. Taze is a community in France that is an ecumenical community, and that has generated over the years a particular approach to worship and to music that is very contemplative. And so we have found that to be a good way of focusing an evening service, kind of a vesper service, with contemplative, meditative chant. That kind of draws you in a way that maybe for some people at least traditional hymnody doesn't, and so it's been interesting to see the kind of people that really connects with and that speaks to.
And I see St. Francis of Assisi is being studied in your adult forum.
That's right. We have one of our members who is who would be a lay Franciscan, I think, if he could be, and a great admirer of Francis. And so any chance we have to work Francis in, he'll take advantage of that.
It sounds like you listened to members of your congregation, and as a result, have quite a varied program.
Yeah, we try to. We're fortunate to have people with a variety of gifts, and so we're eager to tap into those and empower people to offer the kinds of things that they feel called to do.
Tell us a little bit about how your church is organized or governed. And many of our listeners come from different religious traditions, and tell us about yours.
Well, so we're a Presbyterian church connected with the Presbyterian Church USA, which is the largest of the Presbyterian denominations. There are a variety of different denominations that go by the name Presbyterian. But we're in relationship with the Presbytery, which is the sort of regional gathering of churches, which in our area consists of 130, 140 some odd churches. And I think one thing that kind of distinguishes Presbyterians is about our polity is we really value sort of equal representation among clergy and lay people. It's not a hierarchical kind of top-down model as in some denominations, and it's not a purely democratic model as in others, but it really there's a balance there between elders, lay people who are ordained to serve as leaders, and clergy. So we can't do anything just on our own. We have to work together.
And those elders are elected, I know.
Those are elected by the congregation, exactly. It's kind of representative democracy. And we make it a point when we're doing that. I just came out of a nominating committee meeting earlier this afternoon. We make it a point when we're sitting down each year to think about who's going to be on our session, on our governing body next year, who's going to be on the Board of Deacons. Make it a point to make sure that the diversity of our congregation is represented in the leadership of our congregation.
Well, let me thank you, Reverend Wallace Bubar, for being our guest today on Keeping the Faith. Thank you so much for taking time out of your obviously very busy schedule to talk with us for an hour.
And absolutely.
Appreciate it.
It was a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you. Wallace Bubar is pastor of the Overbrook Presbyterian Church in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, on the corner of City Avenue and Lancaster Avenue in the Overbrook Farms area of Philadelphia. If you'd like to see more about their services, go to overbrookpresb.org to find out more information. I'm Steve Shoemaker, the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs, and I get the fun each week, or almost every week, of talking with some fascinating people in the Illinois-Indiana region, where WILL is the NPR regional station. But I also get to talk by phone with people around the country and sometimes even around the world. I mentioned January 6, 2013. We hope to be talking with Pastor John Sutherland, who is probably listening today online, in Palestine. So on the Orthodox Christmas Eve, since that follows a different calendar than other folks, we hope to be talking live with Pastor Sutherland in Bethlehem. Coming up next week here on Keeping the Faith will be an archive program. Ron Sider is a theologian, founder of Evangelicals for Social Action. His new book out this year is called Fixing the Moral Deficit, A Balanced Way to Balance the Federal Budget. Very pertinent topic, obviously, and we're replaying a program that was broadcast first last June. So that'll be November 25th here on Keeping the Faith. Following week, Laura Frericks will be our guest. She's the director of the University of Illinois Research Park. We'll be talking with her about the value of sharing knowledge. On December 9th, we'll be talking with a couple young people who've been doing volunteer service for their denomination. December 16th, Ty Newell, professor of engineering, about crossing the country in a battery-powered vehicle. Thanks for listening to Keeping the Faith.
580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Hi, I'm Jim Fleming, host of To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI. Looking for something to talk about at your next party or around the water cooler on Monday morning? Check in on To the Best of Our Knowledge each week. Science and religion, rethinking animal intelligence, maybe how memory works. Fascinating discussion on To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Sunday evening from 7 to 9 on AM 580. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3, Urbana.